Hello, everybody. This is Richard Anderson. Ever hear about the $6 million man and the bionic woman? Well, I had something to do with that. And you are listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hello, comic book fans. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair, where it is cold outside, but things are heating up here at Comic Book Central. Just wrapped up a series of Flash Gordon episodes. Hope you enjoyed those. I've got a pretty diverse list of guests coming up in the next few weeks. I'm working on a surprise episode with multiple interviews. That's coming up. I think you're going to get a kick out of that one. Lots of comic booky goodness coming your way. You can keep up to date on all things Comic Book Central. Check out the website. Of course, it's comicbookcentral.net. There you're going to find each and every thrill-packed episode, some information about myself, the show, friends of the show, some podcasts and blogs you should be listening to and reading. You can check out the individual show notes for the links to things that are discussed, such as social network links for the guests, links to some of the movies and television shows we talked about. Tons of great stuff out there. And I promise there will eventually be a Comic Book Central shop where you can buy some CBC merchandise. The link is on there. It's coming soon. I know I promised that, but I haven't had a chance to fine-tune that just yet. Rest assured, it is on the way. I know some of you have been asking about that. Speaking about social networks, be sure to follow the show on Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. Give it a like on Facebook, facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. Be sure to subscribe to the show if you haven't already on iTunes. You're not going to miss an episode. There's a link right there on the website. Feel free to review the show on iTunes. That's always appreciated. On iTunes, it is now one of their featured podcasts. So thanks to each and every one of you listeners for contributing to the success of the show by listening, downloading. Oh my goodness, in over 80 countries now. That is unbelievable. So thanks to everyone who's been listening to the show. And a quick thanks to Dante, Jake, and Evan for making things so much easier and much more entertaining here at the Lair. Really appreciate all you've done. All right, on to today's show. Let's just say some episodes of Comic Book Central hit home for me more than others. That is especially true of today's guest. In the mid-70s, I, like many of you out there, I'm sure, ran around in slow motion, jumped over things, went, na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. We're all pretending to be the $6 million man, or for the female listeners, you're pretending to be the bionic woman. I had the action figure. It was one of my favorite toys at the time. I had the coloring books. Yes, I even had a red jogging suit with white stripes. Yep, nerd from day one. You can probably figure that out. If you haven't already, go back and check out episode 23 of Comic Book Central. That's my interview with writer-producer Kenny Johnson. He wrote and produced on The $6 Million Man. He created the show, The Bionic Woman. That's a great interview. I loved it. Story after story. He also created The Incredible Hulk television series, V. Tons of stuff out there. Go check it out, episode 23. Today, on Comic Book Central, I am talking with the man who sent Colonel Steve Austin on each and every mission he had, while at the same time on another network, he gave the bionic woman, Jamie Summers, her assignments as well. He is a true Hollywood legend. He's been performing for over 60 years, and he carries a briefcase like no other. He played Oscar Goldman on the hit Bionic shows. He is Richard Anderson. The list of Richard Anderson's acting credits is staggering. His first screen role goes back to 1947's The Pearl for RKO. He worked nonstop in movies and television throughout the 50s, and sci-fi fans remember him fondly as Chief Quinn in the classic film Forbidden Planet, which also happens to feature the first appearance of Robbie the Robot. Crime dramas, action movies, comedies, a lot of westerns. Richard Anderson did it all. In 1972, author Martin Caden wrote the seminal sci-fi novel Cyborg, featuring Steve Austin, a test pilot who was critically injured and repaired with bionic limbs and sent on secret missions by Oscar Goldman. The following year, ABC adapted the novel for the TV movie The $6 Million Man, with Lee Majors as Colonel Steve Austin. However, his mission in that TV movie was handed out by veteran actor Darren McGavin, playing a character named Oliver Spencer. The movie was a hit, a sequel was ordered, and Oscar Goldman made a welcome return to the world of bionics in the form of actor Richard Anderson. In fact, Richard starts off each and every episode of the series, The $6 Million Man.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man.
When Steve's girlfriend Jamie Summers became a huge hit with the TV audience, the Bionic Woman television series was created, and Richard found himself on two hit shows at the same time. Since then, Richard has continued his incredible run of acting roles. He even produced and acted in three highly successful Bionic reunion movies. Well, my guest today, he is one of the all-time greats with a Hollywood career spanning more than six decades. And he knows a thing or two about robots and cyborgs, having appeared alongside Robbie the Robot and the Bionic Duo. I want to welcome to the show Richard Anderson. Richard, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here and have some fun, Joe.
Oh, I'm telling you what, that voice, that takes me back about 40 years. Oh, that, like, you know, I'm 8 years old all over again. That's amazing. Do you ever get that when people come up to you, just like, they just want to hear your voice? They just want to hear Oscar's voice.
Well, the voice is something, you know, that I learned about early on, really realizing that I'm going to be in front of cameras. And you have to kind of understand how to operate that way. It's to keep it down if you have a certain personality, and that's kind of what I do.
I feel like you're going to send me out on a mission or something like that, and call me pal.
Well, I can explain to you that they were it came in handy.
Yes, it did.
Every week with a $6 million man, and after that, the Bionic Woman, and Zorro, yeah.
Great stuff. Well, we mentioned Robbie the Robot. I know a lot of people listening to this podcast remember Robbie the Robot in, man, all kinds of different TV shows and movies, but you were with Robbie from the very beginning. What can you tell us about the film, the landmark film, 1956's Forbidden Planet, where you played Chief Quinn?
Forbidden Planet, yes, that was a huge one. Forbidden Planet was a tough film. And was very grateful when it came out, and to this day, that's, people talk about it to me and mention that.
Yeah, it's a landmark science fiction film. You mentioned it was tough. Was it a really long shoot that you had to do?
Yes, that went on for a long, long time.
Okay,
weeks and weeks. The main thing is, Joe, in all of this, and you're talking about a voice or acting or so on. It reminds when I was under contract at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, I was talking to an actor that was very famous, and I said, acting, there's nothing to it. Put in a good show and always travel first class.
Have you been able to maintain that all these years?
I always remember it.
We know the good show. I just don't know if you travel first class all the time. I'm sure you do. Well, Oscar always travels first class.
Yeah, put on a good show and always travel first class.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, and Forbidden Planet, we still remember that to this day. Now, your original acting background, you started like in high school plays and things like that?
Yes, I did. I was in the Army for about 14 months. And then when I came out, I started to get busy to become an actor. So I went to the Actors Lab, which was a Stanislavski place. For those who know what that means, more simple kind of acting. This was the one. And I couldn't understand any of it, so I left that. And just started to find out how to get a job, and so I did some acting up in Santa Barbara, and I did some acting in Laguna, and it was there that the Hollywood Reporter mentioned my name as being an exceptional actor, an exceptional actor in these plays that I were in. I mentioned several famous actors that reminded me of them. Cary Grant, for example, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. Or that on that level, the highest level, you know.
What do you think you were doing at that time that was making you stand out, just even at such a young age?
Well, in Santa Barbara, I just went and played a part, and they liked it. And when they went to a second part, they gave me a job in that. So I sort of felt that maybe I was getting somewhere. And then went down to Laguna, and I did two parts in there, and both of them worked. And from that, Gregory Peck, they said I was like, you know.
At that early of an age?
That was it, yeah.
And
it was in the Hollywood Reporter and the Daily Variety, and that got me started, and I got an agent that got me going on a show called Lights, Camera, Action. Lights, Camera, Action is simply a place that is alive. It's done right there for the people to watch, and it was on at NBC, one of the big places that were there. And you do scenes, and they gave me a scene to do with a lady. You have four chances to win, and so each script that they gave me, I'd go up there where they write the scripts to do four scenes about ladies. They'd say, well, we want to do some heavy other stuff. I said, no, don't change it. So they did it where I'd meet the lady in the hotel outside, and we'd talk a little bit, and we don't know each other, that we were going to see each other, one of those kind of things. And they'd applaud, and they applauded right, and I won everything, and the whole town was on me.
This was kind of like a reality show of its day or something, like an
American
Star Talent?
That's right, yeah. Lights, Camera, Action.
Man,
look it up.
So this was like a precursor to like all these reality shows, and you won.
Exactly. Oh. It was right there at NBC that did it. And wow. It would be the audience sitting there, and the applauded would decide whether you're all right or not. And that was like Dancing Today, you know? No, the dancing shows, you know them
yeah.
on television?
Well, maybe you'll be on Dancing with the Stars now. Maybe we'll see you show up on that. go full circle with it.
I can't dance, don't ask me.
Well, we know you can sing now.
Yeah, but in any case, what happened was that I got an offer from someone called Grant, one of the owners, one of the guys that did it. They said, he's on, they're trying to reach you, and I didn't know who it was. And then I went to Republic Studios, and he says, I don't know who you are, get out of here. And so I then heard that the people who were running the show said, Cary Grant was the one that talked about you. So I said, I've been at MGM for a while, not playing anything. I was working just in front of publicity. So I called the lady there, Gloria. I said, "Can you put there Cary Grant's on 23?" So she put it on. She says, "Don't tell anybody I'm doing this." And then I got on. I asked for Cary Grant. And he got on. I said, "Hello, I'm Richard Anderson." "Mr. Grant, my God, you're wonderful. I saw you the other night on television. Actually, it was my wife that saw it. And she said, come over and look at this." I said, "Fine." So she looked at it. And so they said, "Well, have lunch. Come out and lunch." I did. And then he's the one that mentioned it to the head of studio, MGM, I did a similar short scene that did it.
So now that was a test for Cary Grant?
The real Cary Grant, yeah. It was his wife. His wife was the one that really called up and asked about it. She's an actress.
Okay.
And his wife said, you know, "You should take this fellow. He's marvelous." So anyway, the head of the studio liked it very much too, and everybody else. Anyway, I went under contract there.
Wow. A seal of approval from Cary Grant. I mean, that's amazing, especially at that young of an age.
He was a fellow that was very open. He was from England and came over very young and got started himself. He's the kind of a man that was very happy that something happened like that to him, and was grateful to other people too, and his wife particularly, who was a very good actress. They enjoyed the scenes that I did.
Wow, and he wanted to pay it forward. That's nice of him to keep that in mind too. We talk about like a lot of these roles. You look at your filmography and all of your television appearances. It's unbelievable the amount of work that you've accomplished. Some of the ones that jumped out at me. You were in an episode of Captain Midnight, Steve Canyon, The Green Hornet. So you've got that kind of comic book, comic strip background. And Zorro, a few episodes of Zorro. What can you tell us about working on Zorro?
Well, that was done over at Walt Disney. They got me on to a lot of films. I thought it was an amazing place because they were doing Zorro. And I'd get dressed in the morning, and we'd go out somewhere out on a horse. It was an extraordinary happening with Zorro.
This is with Guy Williams, too, right?
That's the guy. You know your stuff.
That's it.
So we would sit and have lunch on the screen, and then finally it got to a fact that it's going to be a sword fight. All that kind of stuff went on, and I got a lot of action from that.
Now, did you actually do the sword fighting?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Exactly. Now, did you have any training or any experience in that at all, or was it just like, here's what you're doing for work today?
Yes, when I was, after I got out of the Army and I went to this place I told you about to learn about acting, they taught me some athletic things to do, and that happened to be one of them.
That was one of the things on the resume that they're teaching you was sword fighting?
Yep.
Oh, how fortuitous.
The two of us, yeah.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
Yeah, I've done it several times since in Westerns, yeah.
Okay.
Actually, I started my real career in Westerns. I did a lot of Westerns.
You did?
And, yeah.
Now, what do you like better, Westerns or sort of like action, sci-fi? That kind of
well,
thing. I mean, you've done a bunch of both.
Depends on the script, pal. I did like Westerns. I liked doing them, yeah. And had the opportunity to get out there, mostly outside.
Well, something else that's amazing, two of the shows that I grew up on, these are near and dear to my heart, The $6 Million Man and The Bionic Woman.
Mm-hmm.
You are a huge part of both of those. Let's talk a little bit about that. 1974, we've got The $6 Million Man started. You are Oscar Goldman of the Office of Scientific Intelligence, OSI. I have to ask you right off the bat, though, do you have an Oscar Goldman action figure?
Yeah.
You do have one.
Well, I do. I have them now all over. They're all over the place. And
I love
the big ones.
Yes.
The big ones are those in cardboard that are come up in, you know, big pictures of Oscar Goldman.
You have them mint
pictures,
in box?
But, beg your pardon?
You have them still mint in the box?
Yeah.
Oh. See, that's what I want to hear. That's what I wanted to hear.
Oh. I'm in the boxes, yeah.
Do you have the office and the briefcase?
No, yeah, I'm sitting right here, yeah.
Oh, man.
And I've just been sent all this stuff, you know.
So
like
you've got the little toys with the in the office with his little chair and his little desk.
Yep.
Oh, and that's great. That's what we want to hear.
And then that was a big hit.
Oh, huge.
The $6 Million Man.
Now you weren't in the very first pilot.
Let me put it to you. I just gotten back from a job in Nevada, and they said the studio called and wants you to go over to Universal, and I said, well, when do we want to read for them? It's not reading, they want you. So I went there. I wasn't really feeling too well. Certain things weren't working well, so I brought along my dark glasses, and when I went in to the studio, there was a $6 Million Man. He's on a bed. He'd been hurt badly in the hospital. So that was the scene I had. So I kept the glasses on. I walked up to him and I said, Steve, you're going to be all right now. Just stand up. Let's just take it easy, huh? The person, not the director, but the fellow was all in charge of it.
Oh, the producer. Was it Harve Bennett?
Harve Bennett, yeah. He did that scene. And then next day he came and said, ABC's crazy about you. They love you. You really did a good job yesterday. So we're going to do a 2-hour movie. They had already made one, and it turned out that ABC didn't think that person was the appropriate actor, and they think you're going to be just wonderful in it.
Now, in the initial movie, we have Darren McGavin, who, amazing actor. We love Darren McGavin, but he was a completely different role. It wasn't Oscar Goldman in the very first movie, and it was a very, like, sort of cold bureaucrat.
Stop right there. That was it. I didn't play it that way.
Right. Now, how did you approach the character?
Well, you got to look at the people, and the main thing was to watch Steve Austin, see how he is, and you must realize that I'm his boss, and at the same time, he's been ill, and I want to just quietly explain what we're doing, and it worked.
Yeah, the chemistry between you and Lee Majors was amazing.
And Lee, I let him alone. I didn't, get fancy with him at all. I had things to do every week. There was a new place to go. Long hours for a long, long time, and it hit the numbers right away.
Yeah, it went gangbusters once this came in and went to series. We talk about the relationship between the two of you. It's totally believable. I mean, you really get it. How much of that is work that you two put into it, and how much was just totally natural between the two of you?
Well, he sized me up, and just like I sized him up, and he's a man that's very, very bright, and also he's bright in the area of action, and I would call him in on a job, and he didn't always like it.
Well, I did listen.
As the years went on, he didn't like it either. For a long time. I mean, that was just the acting part.
You sort of take, even in some scenes, like an adversarial approach with him. I mean, in some of the scenes, you two really go at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it has to do with fun. We had a lot of fun.
Well, you always make up at the end of the episodes too.
Yeah.
I want to talk about one of my favorite episodes, season 2, Return of the Robot Maker. So we talk about an adversarial position with Steve Austin. You get to play two roles. You get to play Oscar Goldman, and you get to play an evil robot.
Mm-hmm.
How much fun was that to just go toe-to-toe with Lee Majors in an epic
fight
scene? Well,
no, I found it fun to try it, I'd be sitting at my office, and another man comes in, and the other man is Oscar Goldman.
Yes.
There's two Oscar Goldmans there. And the guy that comes through the window, he just hits the guy that was on the desk, knocks him out, and takes him out.
Yeah, but you get that scene at the end. There's that epic battle at the end where you're, like, picking up stuff and throwing it at Lee Majors and dropkicking him. And, like, how much of that did you get to do, and how much fun was that for you just as an actor to get out from behind the desk and start, like, throwing things as a completely different character?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you have to know how to make it look so. You see. But the interesting part of that sequence was at the end, Steve Austin was standing there with a gun outside, as you know, and there sits two Oscar Goldmans.
Right.
And he knows the one's terrible. He's the one that did a lot of terrible things to Steve Austin. So he shoots, and one's fallen, one falls down. And then I walk over to him and say, "Well, hey, how'd you know?" Well, the answer was that they don't...
Robots have, don't sweat.
That's right.
No, you could say it. I didn't want to take the line from you.
No, I thought I'd let you have it. I mean, you know a lot about movies and stuff. And
oh, I love this show. Yeah, that's how he knows the difference between the two. Yeah. Oh, it's an epic battle. It's a very cool scene from a very cool series. Speaking of cool series, toward the end of season two, spring of 75, writer-producer Kenny Johnson.
I always said it. Pardon me for interrupting.
Oh, no, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Let's get a lady on the show.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what I said. I said it earlier. I said, let's get a lady on the show. And finally someone... honestly, I did say this would be very interesting. It wasn't the ratings were there, but it would be fun to try it. So this Lindsay Wagner was there. She had just been dropped by Universal. They thought she didn't have the right, I can't say it, not looks, but, you know, a certain way of wasn't there. And so they dropped her. And then I saw her out there, and then they put her in as one of the six or seven people, and she won. And the reason was that she was the best. Our first shots were up in Santa Barbara, and she didn't know how to play tennis. So I got out there, and I played tennis all my life. I told her how to do it. Put your hand this way, raise high, and go bang. She did it.
And oh, she did it, and then some.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got The Bionic Woman came in 1976, ran till 78. But started off on The $6 Million Man. So she was only supposed to come in for like that one story, right? And she's
exactly
dead.
It.
She's dead
she,
at the
she
end.
She did, and that's why I told her, you know, on the court, for example, use it right, you know? And then in the scenes, I was a great listener, you know. I'd listen, and we had a couple of scenes, and I just felt very good. And then the studio said, "All right, he went to the head of ABC. So all right, we've got six people here, and we'll." He said, "Not that the fellow that there said, no, we don't want all that. We just want one." And the studio kept fighting that they didn't want her at the institute. If she had been under contract and she lost, you know, she said, and then they said, "Well, she may have lost, but she's going to play this part." And boy, were they right.
I can't imagine anybody else in that
role. Well, they did that. The casting department at the studio, I walked by her one day and she says, "You know, that girl that I said, don't say anymore." I walked away. Well, it turned out that they put her on right away, and it was absolute just excitement to do scenes with her.
Oh, that's the thing that cracks me up about all this is they come in. Kenny Johnson wants to keep her on. The execs say, "No, kill her off. She's dead." And then all of a sudden, the ratings come in on The $6 Million Man, and it's the biggest episode ever. And then all of a sudden, the executives are like, "Can we bring her back to life?" Wow, cryogenics, and Dr. Rudy Wells goes to work, and you're on two series. You find yourself on two series. A little bit of TV history here. I think, were you and Martin Brooks, who played Dr. Rudy Wells, were you the first actors to portray the same recurring characters on two different shows on competing networks simultaneously?
Well, I want to say to the audience here, you said it just right.
Okay, I got it. Yes.
You got it right, just right, you know. That's exactly how it was.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I was doing two shows at once for quite a long time, and I had plenty of work to do, and found that it was very alone in a sense that I had it all together.
How do you as an actor do that? I mean, because you can get in, you can hit your marks, you can say your lines, and that's one thing. How do you, as just Richard Anderson, juggle two different series like that, jumping back and forth? And there's crossover episodes, and there's Bigfoot, and there's robots. And how do you keep all that straight? How do you know what scenes you're working on that day?
Well, the fact is, you got to, when you get home, you got to read the script. The script, and then you got to read the other one, you know. And they may not be the same days, but you got to read the script, and you can get the words as right as you can.
But how do you keep all that in your brain the same? I mean, that's unbelievable to me, to just be able to juggle like that.
Well, you get into the idea of say the words, and the words have to do with the script that you're doing that week, and what's happening to her, and how can I help her? One week she was in jail, and I remember I was waiting outside, and I had a difficult scene to say to get them to take her out, and that was a different moment. It was hard to do. And then I did go in to the mail and to the prison thing, and I got her out. And just that way was enough to make it work.
Wow. And, you know, something I don't think that you get enough credit for is that even though you're playing the same character on two different shows, there are these subtle variations that when you watch the episodes, you treat Steve Austin completely different than you treat Jamie Summers.
Well, you got it right. Joe, it's exactly right. I knew right away the first day that she came into the office, I realized I couldn't treat Steve Austin the way Jamie Summers was. So I would treat her in a different way, in a more quiet way, in a way of maybe treating her that would say that she was doing well.
Almost like a father. And, I mean, almost like a father figure in some sense.
Well, that in a sense it would be. And she got it too, I know, because then it made it more relaxing for her.
Did you talk about that with the two actors?
Not a word.
Oh, wow. No, okay.
No, Steve, and with Steve and I, with him, I had to realize that he'd been hurt. He was almost killed when I met him, so I had to understand that we're in a country that needs help. How's that?
Yeah, I mean, oh, so like a heroic thing, like yeah, that's that sort of very inspirational. Yeah, absolutely. Now with Lindsay's character on The Bionic Woman, how important did you feel when you were doing that series? The role model that she was sort of putting forth for women, because that was like one of the most empowered female roles at that time. She's a school teacher. She's a tennis pro. She's a secret agent. I mean, that was an amazing character. And then you get to send her out on missions.
We're talking about exactly what you see today, which wasn't there. We're talking about women. You see how women are today. They have great opportunity today. There are people in charge of big corporations today in this country, and they've had other opportunities that they never had before. And Lindsay, as the show went on, you heard more of that wish.
Did she get, and she got to have some input into the character as well, right, in some of the stories?
You said it. She went up the first year and would stop casting. I mean, would stop shooting, even in the first year, to let them know. And Johnson, he knew too, that there were things that they want them to do that she doesn't want to do. As of today, the difference is very much to her help. I have known that, and I have watched it. And I had three daughters, so I completely understood that.
It must have been important for you as a dad then, too.
Three daughters, yeah. I have them now, and it's all about women and how they're treated.
Yeah, it was very empowering. I mean, you hear Lindsay in interviews, and she mentions about people coming up to her and saying how much that impacted them as a kid too. So, very groundbreaking, very much a groundbreaking show. You were the executive producer on the Bionic Reunion movies, is that correct?
Yeah.
How important was it to you to bring these characters back in these reunion movies and you got them married off. I mean, to sort of give them a closing of the story. How important was that to you?
Things have changed. See, we made a lot of changes in this and two shows that were so well played around the world everywhere. I remembered the Queen of England had invited Ali and myself to England, or through her people who were interested in health and so forth. And before we went there, we went on one of these. We were in France. We had gone. We were on these little boats, you know, that go on the
like the little gondolas.
Yes, that's right. I said, I got an idea. You ought to make a movie. A movie? Yeah, let's do a 2-hour of the $6 Million Man and Bionic Woman. Not me. I'm going to go fishing. That's all I want to do. Honest to God, that was the way he called it. I'm going fishing and just walked away from
it. It wanted nothing to do with it.
No, not at all. So what I did was I went up to the head man at the studio, Lou Wasserman, I went to, and I said, I'd like to do a 2-hour movie, because he was the new man in there. And so he said, you want to do that? I said, yeah, I think it might work. So he turned to the guy that was in charge of that area. He says, let him do it, you know. So we did the first one.
No, wait, you just said you wanted to do something and you got a greenlit?
I'm trying to tell you.
That's amazing.
Well, why? See, he saw me, you know, in pictures.
You are Oscar Goldman. You saw the amount of work I was there.
He saw me at that studio now 5-6 years,
oh,
you know.
You are Oscar Goldman in real life. You just say things and they happen.
And then, well, wait, that's what happened. He said, you go ahead and do it and you know, get it made. Well, I had to get it made. I had to get...
You had to go get Lee. He's fishing.
I had to get Lindsay to make it, and I had to get Lee to come on.
To drop the fishing pole and come in.
Yeah, and we did, and they put an office for me in there, and I got the writer to do the right thing. He was a good writer. And we did one, and we ended up doing three of them.
Oh, that's amazing. And I love the fact that you're the catalyst behind all this, bringing this in. And Sandra Bullock. You got Sandra Bullock in the Bionics. That's pretty cool, too. A very early role.
Sandy Bullock. I remember when she came on, she had just a couple of scenes. I tell you what happened. We were looking for a lady. And I went to see the head of the studio. And then on the way out, the casting lady was there. And she says, well, what do you want? I said, I just saw a picture of a lady in the other room there, and I think we ought to get her out here. And she says, you don't have to tell me, you know, one of those things, you know. So that's how she came out.
Don't tell me how to do my job, right?
Well, of course, you know. And I wasn't saying a word, because they go so far sometimes when they see what happens in a studio with just what the hell is he anyway? He's only an actor.
he's only the executive producer, the guy that made all this happen, and they got Lee Majors out of the fishing boat.
Now, that's the truth of everything that I've said, and it all sounds very much not trying to push on it. It's just that I love the work I do, and there was a time when I was able to do it.
Oh, well, we love the work you do, too. We've got a new $6 million man coming up, a $6 billion man. Have they talked to you at all about a cameo or anything? Any
involvement? Well, you know, I think it's a great idea. That's all. Whatever happens.
Yeah.
I hear about it a bit. I go to these conventions, and they're hearing about it, too, when I come up. And I say, well, I don't know how that works. And they just say, well, it's such a great idea, just as it's getting made, you know. But
would you like a cameo in it? Would you like a
little? Well, you're just, here he goes, Joe. I'm not saying that it's meaning anything. No.
Okay.
I just think it's a great. My daughter Deva, she says she works with Tom Hanks all the time in music, and wonderful lady. And she heard about it. She said, "Dad, I think it's a good idea, no matter what." And yeah. She's right. That it's made.
I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you about it. So I, you know, gotta ask you about the new one. So, well, you mentioned conventions. What are you up to now? I see you're at like conventions all the time. You're still making crazy amount of appearances.
I do some conventions, and my next one's going to be up close, but usually I'm long places away. Between March and April, there'll be a book being written about me.
Oh, okay. Do you have the title of it?
We're still in the middle of that right now.
Okay.
But
we'll look for that coming up. You're going to do some book signings?
Of course I will. Yeah.
Oh, great.
They've got it all set up for me to travel and everywhere.
Hey, just to kind of wrap things up here, what's your impression of the shows? What's the legacy that you think that these shows have? What do you want fans to remember?
More across the world than even the United States. People that watch it over there, they see an American story, and it's still that way.
Well, these are certainly role models for us to look up to. Those are certainly heroic figures. Smart, intelligent, gave us something to look up to. They're certainly two of my all-time favorite shows. I have to say, you're a major part of both of them, so I thank you for the memories that I have for these characters. I thank you for bringing them back and getting them married. That was awesome. And Richard Anderson, I thank you for joining me on the show today.
Well, Joe, it was a pleasure. You asked the right questions, and all best to you.
I don't know if you listeners caught it, but at one point in the interview, Richard did call me pal. Now, two things about that. First, it tells me there's a lot of Richard Anderson in Oscar Goldman. He's always calling Steve pal. That's why I believe the character works so perfectly. There's so much Richard Anderson in there. It's believable. It's a great character. The second thing is, 8-year-old Joe's brain nearly exploded during that moment. Now, that was pretty fun to hear that. I admit I did have to keep the fanboy in check at that part of the interview. Just one of the many fringe benefits of chatting with these talented folks who've been appearing on our TV screens all these years. Now, if I can only get Dr. Rudy Wells to install some bionic parts in me, that would be kind of cool, too. Big thanks to Richard Anderson for dropping by the Lair today. If you don't have them, go get the $6 Million Man and Bionic Woman DVD sets. All the episodes, the original TV movies, documentaries, commentaries, Maximilian the Bionic Dog, they're all there. And of course, the great Richard Anderson is there as well. The book, I do have the title right here, Richard Anderson, A Memoir, From the Golden Years of MGM and the $6 Million Man to Now. The author is Alan Doshna, and you can pre-order the book. It's due out in March at bearmanormedia.com. It's bearmanormedia.com. I'll put the link up in the show notes. You can check him out on Facebook as well. I'll put that link in the show notes as well over on my website, comicbookcentral.net, where you're going to find out everything you need about the show. Be sure to check out Comic Book Central on Facebook. I'm putting some very cool pics and videos there. You're going to like those. Facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. Share the Lair. Follow Comic Book Central on Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. And be sure to drop me a line. I want to hear from each and every one of you. Joe@ComicBookCentral.net. Or you can click the Signal Me tab on the website, ComicBookCentral.net. Speaking of emails, Virtual Willie Lumpkin stopped by with a few email and message deliveries. As I mentioned last week, friend of the show Michael Gray, who played Billy Batson on Shazam, you can hear him back on episode 10 of Comic Book Central, by the way, he's going to be on an upcoming episode of the FX animated series Archer. He did send the date and time in. That's going to be March 26th at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on FX. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure you are as well. I heard from Kane Dorr on the Facebook page. Kane wrote in, "I just discovered you. Great podcast. I jumped around a bit and settled on the Erin Gray episode. As you began listing her guest appearances, I feared you'd skip Magnum, but thankfully that was not true. Not only did you emphasize J. Digger Doyle, you asked her about the backdoor pilot straight away. Good show. Now, thanks, Kane. Love that interview. Aaron Gray was amazing. Any chance to get a Magnum reference on the show, I am totally about that. So, yeah, never worry about that. Anytime I can mention Magnum PI, I will. Thanks for listening. And finally, on today's show, I heard from Matt Haberman, also on Facebook. Matt writes, "Hi, Joe. I love the show. Even when I'm not familiar with the guests, you manage to consistently deliver an entertaining podcast. I really enjoyed the Howard the Duck episodes. After seeing the film in the theater as a kid, I went on a quest to find as many Howard comics as I could. In the podcast episodes, you and your guests maintain the relationship between Howard and Beverly was strictly platonic and innocent. That may be true in the movie, but it was a different matter entirely in the comics." Well, thanks for writing in, Matt. Glad you enjoyed those beak-to-beak Howard the Duck episodes with Ed Gale and Chip Zion. Those were fun. Episodes 54 and 55, if you haven't checked them out already. Yeah, on that topic, we kept our conversation strictly to what was in the movie, which I know it deviated from the books in many ways, from the comic books and the subsequent magazines. There, in those comics and magazines, the relationship is quite different, yeah, to be sure. But as you heard on the show, once things enter into the live-action arena, it's a whole different ballgame. So I'm sure the writers, producers, and directors struggle with that. It's never easy adapting material from one form to another, so it is kind of fun to see how they do it. It's also kind of fun to see how they fail to do it. Sometimes that's almost as entertaining as well. Hey, thanks for listening and writing in. Well, that is it for today, folks. I'm going to slow motion run out of here, but I will return shortly because next week on Comic Book Central, he played in the Hunger Games, he threw down with Shredder as a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, and he was the king of the seven seas on Smallville. Actor Alan Ritchson will be joining me to talk about Aquaman and so much more. Until then, have an amazing week, keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the Lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Hey, Joe, that was fun.